court is ready to hear argument in 050739 Dominion Oklahoma Texas Exploration and Production Inc. versus Castle Texas Oil and Gas Limited Partnership and others.
May it please the court, Mr. Farnsworth will present argument for the petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 4 minutes for rebuttal.
Good morning. Good morning. Farnsworth for Dominion. It's time in the private sector, at least among sophisticated business people, to eliminate or at least redefine the voluntary payment rule. This is because it's, one, counterintuitive, two, it has led to inconsistent results in the courts of the state over time, and three, it's not justified.
What impact, if any, does the BMG case have on this?
I don't think the BMG case has any impact, because I think, as the court correctly pointed out in the BMG decision, Section 6 of the new draft restatement, Comment C, clearly says that in that situation where you have an agreement entered into between, in this case, BMG and the various recipients of the software or the disks, there was an allocation of risk of whether or not these payments were, in fact, confiscatory penalties or whether they were, in fact, justified based on BMG's costs for late payments. The court correctly pointed out that in the new restatement, in the definition I would submit the court needs to adopt, the result would be identical. Briefly, the facts. In July of 1977, a company called Samco owned a series of oil and gas leases in what became the very prolific Southwest Speaks Field in Lavaca County, Texas. It sold these leases and retained, one of the things it retained, was an overriding royalty, a sliding scale that depended upon the then existing burdens on the lease when the override attached. In March of 1980, Petrosil, the then owner of the leases, resold them, if you will, to TXO and Samigan, and in that sale document, it retained an override that was measured between the difference of the then existing March 1980 burdens and 25%. Essentially saying that if existing burdens were 25%, it would be zero. Things rocked along, wells were drilled, production was obtained. In the mid-1990s, a company called Castilla Energy acquired an interest in the Southwest Speaks Field, and in particular acquired a 100% interest in the Mitchell lease, the lease we're talking about in this case. It drilled a very prolific gas well, and as is common in the industry, it commissioned a title examiner to say, okay, how do I divide the proceeds that I obtained from the production from this well? In October of 1977, a title opinion was issued in which the title examiner kind of reversed the situation and said the Petrosil override should be considered first, the Lyle St. Martin second. Pursuant to that title opinion, as is again common in the industry, Castilla sent out division orders. And it said, each division owner said, here's the interest we think you own. We would like you to confirm or certify that's accuracy. Ambrit, Castle's predecessor, signed the division order. It came back to Castilla. Payments were made under it. In July of 1999, Castle acquired Ambrit's interest. And as part of the transfer, Castilla said, look, you need to sign a division order. And that division order was identical and said, we certify the interest, 10.6%, set forth in the title opinion rendered in October 1997.
Let me just interrupt you for a minute.
Sure.
In BMG, we kind of said that if you pay a claim in the face of a known uncertainty,
correct,
then voluntary payment rule kicks in.
Correct.
And this title opinion states that it relies on a particular assumption. And apparently that assumption was wrong. And therefore, doesn't the statement that it relies on an assumption, isn't that analogous to an uncertainty that would kick in the application of the voluntary payment rule, whether it's law or fact? It's expressed uncertainty.
I don't believe the title opinion said there was uncertainty as to how the overrides line up. What I think that title opinion said was there was uncertainty as to whether the Lyle St. Martin override existed. So there's an argument that when Lyle St. Martin sold their working interest, along with it went the override, But they said, but since it's been paid, we won't question that. We could not determine from the title opinion why the examiner lined them up differently. She didn't explain herself, and quite frankly, in subsequent conversations, she wasn't able to do so either. All we know is she did it.
But she said we're making assumptions based on underlying documents.
Well, sure, absolutely. She literally examined all the documents and essentially determined the interest of everybody based upon a review of those documents. That's correct.
And if you say we're relying on underlying assumptions, but you don't look at those underlying assumptions to see if they're accurate, aren't you sort of analogously paying in the face of a recognized assumption or uncertainty? And why wouldn't that kick in the voluntary payment?
Well, in the oil and gas industry, what happens is a title examiner is retained, is hired to do an opinion. That opinion is issued. Oftentimes, there are requirements. There are assumptions and requirements that, of course, are reviewed by the company, who then says, look, we'll either do the curative or we'll waive the curative. But they send out division orders saying to everybody who claims an interest and who the title opinion says has an interest, confirm for us that this is what you own. To some degree, there's a check and balance to what the operator sees in his title opinion. I mean, yes, you could say that every time an operator pays an owner in the state of Texas, there is some uncertainty, because anytime you're looking at a construction of documents, someone has to interpret those documents to find out what they say.
And if you misconstrue it, is that a mistake of fact or law?
I submit it's a mistake of fact. I'll get to that a little bit in just a moment, if I may.
Which title opinion are you talking about, the first or the second?
The October 1997 title opinion was on the Mitchell lease done by Miss Haley. The second title opinion I'm going to talk about in a minute was done by Charles Anderson in March of 2002. Well, in April of 2000, Dominion, in a bankruptcy auction, essentially buys for $125 million all of Castilla's assets, one of which was a Mitchell lease. It continues doing what Castilla did. And in early 2002, Mr. St. Martin calls and says, look, I'm only getting 4%. I think I should get 5%. We pull the documents, look at them, hire Charles Anderson, and say, who had done title work for Dominion and Southwest Peaks Field, say, tell us what's right. Charles goes in, looks at it, and says, Miss Haley lined them up wrong. She should have counted the Lyle St. Martin override first and given them 5%, and the Petrosil override or the Castle override second, which reduces them from 10.6 to 7.1. Based upon that second title opinion, Dominion filed a declaratory judgment action in Lavaca County, in this case, to have the court determine who's right. It started paying Lyles and St. Martin the amount set forth in the Anderson opinion, and it started attempting to recoup overpayments for Castle. In May of 2000, Castle, having sold its interest to Delta and BWAB, those recoupments stopped. Dominion essentially recouped roughly $97,000. It has still to recoup almost $800,000. In May of 2004, on motions for summary judgment, the trial court in Lavaca County ruled that the Anderson opinion was correct, the overrides were misaligned, and ordered Castle to make restitution. In July of 2005, the 13th Circuit affirmed the trial court's determination on the alignment of the overriding royalties, but reversed, saying the voluntary payment rule prohibited Dominion from getting a reimbursement. Now,
it seems to me like in BMG, we said payment has to be made in the face of not just an uncertainty, but a recognized uncertainty.
Correct.
So for the literal wording of BMG to apply, it seems to me, you would have to have known the interests weren't properly aligned and paid anyway. But this case seems to present is if there are warning flags that show you should have known, does the voluntary payment rule apply? Now, I agree, your position is
you know, we have to rely on these assumptions, and that's not necessarily a warning flag we should look into. But I think that's the argument that they're making. And how do you address the sort of should have known piece?
Well, I think if you apply the new restatement, you essentially get to the same place, a recognized uncertainty. Was there a recognized uncertainty? Clearly there wasn't here, because Castle believed the title opinion it got. It issued division orders, as, again, customary in the industry, say, tell us if we're right. And Castle said, yeah, you are. So there was no uncertainty that came to anyone's attention until Mr. St. Martin called Dominion and said, gee, I'm not getting enough. Now, why Mr. St. Martin signed his own division orders for a lesser amount, I have no clue. But he called and said, I should get five, not four. We looked at the situation, hired a title examiner. That would be, in my view, when a recognized uncertainty would take place, when it was called to our attention. And at that point in time, of course, there may have been some time between we called our attention until we got the title opinion. But once we got that title opinion, we started acting in accordance with what it said. When I say the voluntary payment rule has led to inconsistent results, I want to talk about two cases. In Pennell versus United Insurance, the 1951 decision that the 13th Circuit held its hat on in this case, this court ruled that it was a situation where United Insurance had issued a disability policy, providing for double indemnity in the event of a injury in a car purely of the passenger type. Injury took place in a Jeep. United paid double indemnity payments for a time, then said, gee, I made a mistake. I want my double payments back. This court said, no, that's a mistake of law. You can't recover. However, fast forward 21 years to 1972, in a decision out of the San Antonio Court of Appeals in Singer versus St. Paul Mercury Insurance, the question was, Singer had an insurance policy on a building. On the same property was a small outbuilding. The outbuilding burned. It filed a claim. St. Paul came out, did an examination, said, yeah, our policy covers the outbuilding. They issued a draft for the loss. They then said, oh, we made a mistake. We shouldn't have issued this draft. We want our money back. San Antonio Court of Appeals said, that's a mistake of fact. You should get your money back. This court NRE'd that decision. The second problem with the voluntary payment rule is, what is a mistake of fact versus what's a mistake of law? The Court of Appeals said the interaction and interpretation of legal documents is a question of law, not fact. Professor Farnsworth, in the 2004 Law of Contracts, said, when a court interprets a contract, it takes an unambiguous contract, it takes the words used by the parties and determines what they mean. That's a determination of a fact, not law. The 1937 Restatement of Restitution, as cited favorably by the Commission, by the First Circuit in Houston, 1991, Commission Mutual Insurance versus Owen, said that a mistake of law is a mistake as to the legal consequences of an assumed state of facts.
So when the attorney says, this is their interest because production's coming from this, this, and this horizon, but in fact, it was coming from different horizons, is that a mistake of fact or of law?
I would think that'd be a mistake of fact.
Even though I hired the attorney to tell me what the amount I should pay is. The attorney's giving me a legal opinion.
That's correct. I still think it's an interpretation of the documents, which I say is a mistake of law, a mistake of fact.
Restatement third says, because of hypotheticals like mine, there's no way you're going to be able to separate questions of fact and questions of law.
That's correct. It does say that.
Let me ask you on the I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Are you familiar with the Apache case out of the Houston Court of Appeals a couple months ago?
I'm not, Your Honor.
I'm concerned if instead of Castle Oil and Gas Limited, instead of a bunch of doctors, I suppose, in a limited partnership. If this had been a widow lady sitting at the other table who had been sent money and spent it to live on, and the same rule's going to have to apply to her that applies to them. And don't we run into the problems we mentioned in BMG and Bolton, that the widow lady takes the money and spends it, and now we sue her, please pay us back $750,000. There is some inequity there.
There is a change, but you could hold that on a change of circumstances. If you recall, one of the things the restatement says is if you have a change of circumstances, that is a ground for not granting restitution, and a ground that the courts have upheld. This court, on occasion, has said if the parties have changed their position, if you will, based upon a mistake, no restitution will take place.
So you pay every one of your interest holders the wrong amount. The doctors have to pay it back, but the widow ladies get to keep it.
Well, I mean, I hear again you talk about change.
Is that the rule of law, or is that the rule of welfare?
Maybe a rule of equity, but clearly I think under either the restatement or, quite frankly, under the voluntary payment rule, they should be required, both should be required to pay it back. Whether the widow lady would be able to or not might be another question.
But so we decide the voluntary payment rule by finding how much asset you've got and how hard it would be to pay it back. That's going to be a problem.
Well, I don't think that's how the voluntary payment rule works. Voluntary payment rule, as I think it should work, with getting rid of the mistake of fact versus mistake of law distinction. If, in fact, there's been an erroneous payment made, there should be restitution. Now, whether there are circumstances that might impact that is something I think that I haven't, quite frankly, looked at the redraft restatement about that, but there are talks about changed circumstances, and there are cases that say changed circumstances. If the recipient has changed its position in reliance on the payments, the courts have held no restitution.
And that is, in effect, don't you think, just a way of applying standard restitution or estoppel or waiver or ratification law, rather than coming up with a new animal called voluntary payment rule?
Absolutely.
We've got existing doctrines to cover the situation you're talking about.
That's correct.
Any further questions? Thank you, Mr. Farnsworth. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court. Ms. Rowe will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court. I'm Laura Rowe, here for Respondent Castle. I think the most important point I can try to make today is that this case presents a classic, simple example of a mistake of law that doesn't justify abandoning or abrogating the important policy behind the voluntary payment rule.
Well,
that this court...
I understand in the briefing, everyone seems to have said that we reinforce that distinction in BMG, but I didn't read BMG that way. I thought BMG sort of did the fact and law distinction as sort of, and furthermore, kind of fits that paradigm. We didn't really put a stamp of approval on it. It was just more of a, by the way, it fits that as well. We did lean more towards the restatement position, which was, if you pay something in the face of a recognized uncertainty, and can you, rather than try to fit it into the law or fact situation here, can you address more that analysis?
Absolutely, and I could say BMG, and I think this case as well, fit the test under both the draft restatement and under the classic definition of the voluntary payment rule as it has been used in Texas, which does distinguish between mistake of law and mistake of fact. And I do think BMG says at one point that it's well settled in Texas that a mistake of law won't excuse or isn't a defense to a voluntary payment. But this case, I think, like BMG, because there is a recognized uncertainty, would fit either test. And recognized uncertainty here is really in two respects. First, there is, and everyone has agreed, there's a recognized uncertainty in oil and gas title. That's why people do title opinions. That's why Dominion, in this case, when it acquired its interest, went and by the affidavit of its own senior counsel said, we went and checked and we did due diligence at least to make sure we got as much net revenue interest as we thought we were getting under the title opinions. So Dominion did do some action here. They did go and look and say, under that original title opinion, the Haley opinion, we're going to get at least 71% of the net revenue interest here. They checked that out. What they didn't check was for the people that we owe the rest of it to, is that correct? They didn't bother to go there. They just looked for themselves and said, well, I don't necessarily want to look at the rest. I want to just make sure I'm going
to
be okay.
Well, do they have an obligation to do that?
I think, Your Honor, certainly it's the better policy that the obligation be on them, that they not just be able to check for themselves and leave the royalty owners, the abandoned,
but
the widow lady.
Due diligence is usually done by sampling records, not looking at every one. It would be prohibitively expensive.
That, I think that's true, Your Honor, but I think what this is, it just has nothing to do with the sampling of records. It's got to do with a choice that they made that said, I just want to check out my own interest. I don't care about what I owe everybody else, and I don't care if it's right. I'm not. That's not something I want to choose to do.
No. What did anybody do or say that recognized the amount you were being overpaid was because of a recognized uncertainty?
Well, first of all, I think that there is an inherent...
Other than oil and gas is always uncertain, and who knows, even though we've been paying people for 100 years this amount, who knows if it's right or wrong? But, I mean, in this case, what was there anybody said or did that suggested they were uncertain?
In the first title opinion, the Haley title opinion, there was a dispute about whether or not the Petrosilla override should bear the expense of the Lyles-Bassama override. And there's three or four different legal theories about, and they're purely legal theories. Was the Lyles-Bassama override an existing burden of record at the time that the Petrosilla override was created, such that it should bear on Petrosilla's 25% minus? In other words, in the simplest theory, I think, to understand, and one I thought was a winner, but it didn't win in the Court of Appeals, was that the Lyles-Bassama override wasn't an existing burden of record because it had not vested at the time that the Petrosilla override was created, because it's a deep well override only in the deep zones, and there was no production in the deep zones when the Petrosilla override was created. And in fact, this interpretation is exactly what everybody lived with for the entire amount of time. TXO agreed never, I mean, the TXO subsequently also entered to another agreement that said, you're right, we're never going to burden the Petrosilla override with the Lyles-Bassama override. So that's what the title examiner, and there are a couple other theories. Did it run with the land? Did the covenant run with the land? Did it vest? But it was a legal term of art, existing burden of record. And the legal dispute was whether or not, and again, the three or four theories about whether or not the Lyles-Bassama override was an existing burden of record in 1980 when the Petrosilla override was created. And that was certainly a dispute. That's a dispute in the Haley opinion. That's why she reached her legal conclusion that, in fact, no, the Petrosilla override shouldn't have the Lyles-Bassama override deducted from its value. And what's really interesting here is that the second title opinion on which Dominion now relies, the Anderson opinion, explicitly recognizes this dispute. It says, you know, we know that the other people see it the other way. There's an issue about vesting. And you can look at that in the record. I think it's at 335, 336. And it explicitly recognizes that there's been a legal issue and a legal dispute about whether or not the Petrosilla override should bear the cost of the Lyles-Bassama override.
What about the argument that Dominion knew the legal obligation to pay the override payments, but just made a mathematical mistake of fact in computing the amount?
That's a different case, but that's certainly not what happened here. And in fact, I could direct the court's attention to an excerpt from the record that I had distributed this morning. And it's a perfect example. This is from the first title opinion, the Haley opinion, that reached the legal conclusion that the Lyles-Bassama override did not bear on the Petrosilla override. Ironically, there's a mistake of fact in this title opinion that nobody has noticed until I was looking at it, I think maybe even just yesterday. If you look at the second page...
You're going to bring another lawsuit because of that?
Hopefully we're going to settle this all today, Your Honor. But if you look at the second page under overriding royalty interests, you see Martin and Lyles, and you see that they both have 2% of 8/8. If you look in the further column, one gets that correct in the decimal percentage, but the second one gives them 20%. That'd be a mistake of fact. That'd be a classic accounting error. If this had been entered into the paydex, and it wasn't, and there's no dispute on that, I think, between the parties, Lyles-Bassama were paid 4%. They weren't paid 22%. That'd be a mistake of fact. That's a classic example of a mistake of fact. And what we had here, that didn't get entered into the system. It didn't matter. That'd be like Gulf Oil. That'd be like the whole case. What we had here was a different legal interpretation about whether or not the Lyles Basama override should bear on the Petroskoe override.
When you started, you talked about the important policies behind the voluntary payment rule. Let's put the public sector voluntary payment rule to the side. I'm just talking about it in the private sector in this case. If I owe Justice Heck money, and I pay him for 2 years, and then I realize, oh, I've been paying him too much. Then we get into a dispute about whether I can get it back from him, the part that I overpaid. There's the doctrine of waiver, which can be proven or not proven. There's estoppel, there's ratification, there's restitution, all established doctrines in the law that can determine whether or not I get some of the money back. Undisputed, though, that I overpaid. Why can't we rely on existing well-defined doctrines to determine who wins that dispute about the excess payment? And let me just clarify. There's no dispute here that what was paid by Dominion was more than they were required to pay. Is that true? I didn't see anyone contest that proposition.
Not in this court. It was contested below.
But not
absolutely. We disagreed and said we were entitled to have the full Petrosil override without the deduction of the
But in this court, it's not disputed that Dominion overpaid.
We have chosen not to appeal.
Okay. So then back to my example. Why can't we rely on waiver, estoppel, ratification, those existing documents, rather than a rule that says we don't care if you are entitled to get it back. You can't get it back because you paid it as a volunteer.
Well, Justice Wainwright, I think that there are certainly those doctrines are available, and this case was certainly tried without the benefit of your concurrence in BMG. And if it was tried again, I'm sure that those doctrines would be raised, but they're not raised in this case. But I think the policy underpinnings of the voluntary payment rule are a little more specific. And as this court said in BMG, this court is interested in protecting the finality of payments in Texas. And the voluntary payment rule does that. It draws a line. It says, we don't want people continually going back to the courts. We're going to draw a line here and protect the finality of payments. When
not
people
all,
make a mistake,
not all payments.
No, when people make a mistake of fact, we draw the line and we say, we understand that's a typo in the title opinion. It says 20%, not 2%. That's bad. Gee, we know you didn't need to pay your utility bill twice, and the company certainly didn't expect to get 2 October payments from you. But when the parties have a different expectation, as in this case, that everybody thought that the original title opinion was correct, it would reach its legal conclusion, and everybody got paid under that title opinion, it's a different policy. We want to enforce the parties' expectations here. So going forward, if we were all wrong under a mistaken conclusion
there. So if I'm receiving the royalty payments and I got $750,000 too much, I'm the widow in the prior example, you think my expectation would be that I still should be allowed to keep it as a layperson, a member of the public who's not read all this restatements and case law about the voluntary payment rule?
And you'd be enforcing, if the widow lady was in a situation like Castle in this case, you'd be enforcing the expectations of the parties. When Dominion bought its interest in this case, it thought it was getting a 71% net revenue interest. It thought it had burdens of about 29%, including the 4% Lyles Basama override that they thought it was at the time, and 12.5% on the royalty owners, and about 12.5% on the overriding royalty for Petrosil. They thought they had a 71% net revenue interest. That's what they paid for. That's how they valued the transaction. That's what the affidavit of their senior counsel says. Castle, on the other hand, thought it had about a 12.5% override. It's really 10% because they only own 96% of the 12.5%, which is why it's the 10%. And that's when this starts to get awfully complicated. But the party's expectations were as outlined in the legal opinion, in the Haley opinion. So it's not, if anything, now Dominion, under the Anderson title opinion, has got about a 75% net revenue interest. All of a sudden, they've gotten a better deal than they bargained for, and good for them. That's great. But and Castle's gotten a worse deal. This isn't a zero-sum game here. Dominion's going to end up with more money in its pocket because of this interpretation, and it's more money than they thought they were getting when they acquired their royalty interest. So in that case, the equities, especially when Dominion chose to say, we just want to check out and make sure we're okay, but we're not going to worry about our royalty owners, and they're the ones with all the information and all the facts. You certainly can't charge the royalty owners with the duty, or it wouldn't be economically efficient to get 20 title opinions from all the different world tenders. Dominion's the one who has the obligation to pay and has the facts about knowing what to pay. Certainly in that case, it's appropriate to say we'll change it going forward. The law, we were under a mistaken conclusion of the law, but we don't want to change it going back.
Are you, Ms. Rowe, aware of the 14th Court's opinion in Apache a couple months ago?
Yes. And in Apache, I think a little bit like this case, it's a mistake of law case, mistake as to the ownership of the condensate. And the court applied the classic, simple, old-style voluntary payment rule, as you will, and said you can't recover for the overpayment for the condensate because you paid because you didn't know how much condensate you owned. And I think that case, like this case, would also probably fall out the same under the voluntary payment rule as classically defined or under the new proposed restatement. But I think it's important for the court to recognize that the proposed draft restatement does change the law somewhat in Texas. It's going to, generally speaking, allow for more claims of restitution. You've eliminated the mistake of law, mistake of fact distinction if the court was to adopt the new draft restatement.
Which and we don't have to adopt.
Absolutely not, Your Honor.
Now, if there is a recognized uncertainty and Dominion, as you framed it, and Dominion paid anyway, then you're going to win on waiver or estoppel or something when you go back down, aren't you? Because there was a debt. They were uncertain about whether to pay it or not. Could have disputed it. Instead, paid it.
Well, I'm hopeful that we don't have to go back down, Your Honor, first of all. But I certainly would think we could win under those doctrines, but I think those doctrines don't necessarily address all the concerns of the voluntary payment rule, which involve protecting the finality of payments and allowing a payee to go ahead and rely on its payments. And I think the widow lady is not a bad example here.
Protecting the finality of payments is an important goal, but someone can argue that protecting wrongful payments is a different goal and maybe more important or in some instances if the payment was improperly or inaccurately made. So I'm not sure we can just say blanketly the finality of payment should justify everything going on with the VPR, voluntary payment rule.
I agree. I think it's a tension and there's a place to set the line. The court has chosen to set the line between mistake of fact and mistake of law, or at least Texas law generally has over the last 150 years. It's sort of a Chevy truck. It's a workhorse. It's a rule that has been flexible. It's an equitable rule, and it's worked pretty well. I'd submit that maybe the draft restatement is a little bit of a shiny new car that hadn't been crash tested yet, and it hasn't really passed its emission standards, and we don't really know how it's going to work. In the oil and gas context, we've got a plethora of cases that apply the voluntary payment rule and generally do it pretty darn well. It's easy. Mistake of fact versus mistake of law isn't all that hard. I think mistake of fact, it's just like the typo in this title opinion. It's just like, oops, you know, the price of oil in the Gulf case is $3.15, but we forgot to deduct the transportation. Nobody's disputing whether or not what the real price was. Everybody knows what the terms of the contract says and the meaning of those terms. Here we had a dispute as to the meaning of the terms of the contract, and that changes the equities a little bit. I think there's one interesting point to be made under the comments to the new draft restatement, and specifically, in comment D of section 6, the draft restatement says, if the party making the payment assume the risk that the relevant facts are other than supposed, the payment does not become involuntary. And I think that applies here, too, as well, because Dominion did take on the risk that the facts would be other, the facts for the royalty owners would be other than they assumed when Dominion chose not to investigate those facts. Now, certainly Dominion had the underlying facts. They had the title opinion, and they had the two agreements, the agreements creating the Lyles-Bassama override and the agreement creating the Petrosil override. They had those agreements. They chose to look at them, according to the affidavit of their counsel, to a limited extent. And when they look at them that limited extent, and this also works with Gulf Oil and Hull, which say if you're consciously ignorant of the facts, if you choose to be consciously ignorant, if you assume the risk that the facts that you know you're going to have to pay royalties, but I'm not going to investigate, if you consciously assume that risk or consciously or ignorant, I'm not going to check that part out. I don't want to. I don't have time. I don't feel like it. I think, again, equities would bear to prevent recovery of the overpayment. Going forward is different, but it would prevent recovery of the overpayment under that scenario.
Conscious indifference, but how about plain negligence?
How How about negligence?
Yes.
Meaning, how would that affect negligence in looking at the facts?
Negligence is both a conscious indifference.
What Hall and Gulf Oil say, and they're mistake of fact cases, so I submit that they address when you've made a mistake of fact, which isn't the case here. Dominion didn't make a mistake of fact, they made a mistake of law. In a mistake of fact case, what Hall and Gulf Oil say, if you were just negligent on making your mistake of fact, we still will maybe excuse you and you can get the money back. But if you're consciously ignorant, you can't. That's certainly not the case here. For one thing, Hall and Gulf Oil, that's a standard in when you can recover in a mistake of fact case. It's not a standard that applies to a mistake of law case. But under that standard, conscious ignorance, if this was a mistake of fact here, they'd still be barred from recovering. If I can make one more point here, I think this is a really important context in the oil and gas context in Texas. The Dominion has cited some examples saying that oil and gas law says that the risk should always be borne by the payee, by the lessor or the royalty owners. And that's actually not true. And if the court looks at the commentator cited, every single Texas case in the oil and gas context dealing with voluntary payment and repayment and restitution says mistake of fact, you can recover. Mistake of law, you can't. And there's one, I believe it's a Kentucky case, that says we'll let you recover from mistake of law or mistake of fact. And it's out there. It's the only case out there, period, in the oil and gas context that applies that rule. And there's also further a statute in Texas that deals with division orders. And division orders aren't really an issue in this case. Nobody sued to recover under a division order. But I would like to point out to the court that the statute in Texas that has it's an alternative division order that you can use only applies to oil wells. These wells are gas wells, and it's in the record by an exhibit that Dominion itself submitted. And I'd say that cuts against any supposed policy for Texas allowing recovery and recoupment. And I'd also say, and I think this goes towards what Justice Brister said, it's the lessee who has the knowledge and the resources to check out what's the appropriate way to pay. It's not the individual royalty owners. It's not the widow lady. They've got to rely, and they've got to protect the finality of payment and let them go ahead and use their funds, as this court said in BMG, use their funds unfettered and spend them and go ahead and go on. And the only result here of a different rule would be to throw everybody in suspense and, you know, how does the widow lady live without her royalty check?
Any further questions?
One more. I don't recall seeing any amicus briefs in this case. Is the industry just not real excited about how this turns out either way?
I would submit that certainly, like NARO is certainly interested, but sometimes underfunded.
Thank you, Ms. Brown.
Thank you.
We'll hear
first, apologize to Justice Willard. I must have had an Alzheimer's moment. I remember the Apache case. Apache case is where, in a natural gas gathering system, liquids fell out. The liquids were not measured separately, were dumped in with the natural gasoline, which was extracted from the plant. When Apache complained about not getting paid, in recognition that it didn't know how much it owed, a check was cut. Again, a payment in view of a recognized uncertainty in which the payor never said, yeah, I'm making this estimate, I'm paying you reserving rights. They just issued the check. That case correctly decided that Apache should keep the money. I would like to discuss mistakes of fact versus mistakes of law. We talked about definitions. In Columbia National Fire versus Dixie Co-op, a 1925 Commission of Appeals decision affirmed by this court, and in Furnace versus Furnace, the 14th District decision in 1989 out of Houston, it said, mistakes of law are confined to mistakes of general rules of law, and ownership of private property, including real estate, are always mistakes of fact. I want to talk and final, a little bit about equity. What happened here? Castilla drilled the wells into a known oil and gas reservoir and commissioned a title opinion to say who owns how much of this. I think of it as like a pie. Castilla said, who owns the pie and how big a slice are they entitled to? They got an opinion. The opinion was wrong. It said Castle was entitled to a larger slice than they actually were entitled to.
Yeah, but once that pie is digested, it's hard to give it back. How do you address the equity issues raised by your adversary there, and that it would be your client or companies like your client that could better bear these type of expenses, and that any change should be prospective and not retrospective?
Well, I think what you have here, Your Honor, is not a situation where there's a payment of a claim, not a debt. Castle didn't provide any services, didn't provide any goods, there wasn't an invoice sent. What you really had, and this happens every day in the oil and gas industry, was an operator who, in good faith, says, gee, how do I divide this pie? How much is everyone entitled to? Castle got a bigger slice for a number of years than they were no questionably entitled to. The title opinion said that. Trial court said that. Court of appeals said that. They didn't even appeal it here. There's no question they got more, a bigger slice, than they should have gotten.
But no more than you counted on giving them when you purchased the company.
Actually, that's not true. What Dominion did when it spent $125 million to buy these assets is it went in and it tried to determine, was it entitled to, based on the documents, to get the minimum net revenue interest that it was represented to them they would get. They didn't look at what their override was. They never looked at the documents. They just looked to see how much they were getting. Clearly, they made some mistakes on the good side. They made mistakes on the bad side. It's just part of the process. And it's part of the due diligence not to say, gee, are they getting the correct override? Are Lyles and St. Martin getting the correct override? But does the economics justify the interest that as we look at this, we see we're going to get? You're right. They did look at it. They did make a determination. They did say, okay, it looks correct. The interest represented to us in the packages we looked at to make a bid appear to be consistent with the title opinions. They did do that, no question. No question that there was a mistake here. They got a bigger piece of the pie than they should have gotten. They should pay that back to the people.
Thank you, Mr. Farnsworth. The cause is submitted, and that concludes the arguments for this morning. The marshal will adjourn.
All rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable United States Court of Appeals for the Supreme Court of Texas now stands adjourned.